What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Iran condemns U.S. sanctions on four Iranian nationals, saying the Biden administration is pursuing the failed policy of its predecessor. A Lebanese government delegation is in Syria to discuss importing electricity and natural gas through Syrian soil. And Australia registers more than 1,700 COVID-19 infections, a new record high. Officials warn that the worst is yet to come. Hello and welcome from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Well, Tehran has lashed out at Washington for imposing sanctions on four Iranian nationals. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said the current U.S. administration is unfortunately pursuing the failed policy of its predecessor. He said U.S. officials are resorting to, quote, Hollywood-style scenarios to maintain their sanctions-driven existence. His remarks came after Washington blacklisted four Iranian intelligence operatives for an alleged kidnapping conspiracy on American soil. The U.S. Treasury Department said the sanctions target all the property of the four individuals in the U.S. are in U.S. control and prohibits all transactions with them. They were alleged to be hatching a plot to abduct an anti-Tehran figure in July. Journalist and commentator Mostafa Khoshchesh believes that the U.S. is imposing restrictions against Iran recently shows that Washington's sanctions policy has failed.
Here is a point that it shows us a number of things. I mean, this new allegation that they have raised. First of all, they don't have anything on Iran. Second, so because they are going after such naive plot and plotting and imitating Obama, old-fashioned Obama-style, you know, plotting against Iran. Two, the point in here is that they don't have anything else to sanction. Apparently, some people say that they have Tehran's trees to sanction. They have sanctioned everything they could. And we are now 1.5 years after the peak of efficiency period of the sanctions, and they know it. So they are empty-handed. A look at the sanctions could tell you that. A third point is that this could also be a move to silence domestic opposition by Republicans and others who are critic of the Biden administration's foreign policy.
The Russian military says Syrian air defenses had intercepted most of the missiles Israel fired toward Damascus on Friday. 21 out of the 24 rockets fired by Israeli warplanes using Lebanese airspace were said to be destroyed mid-air before reaching their targets. Damascus issued another call to the United Nations to condemn the Israeli regime's attacks. The Syrian Foreign Ministry made the call in letters addressed to the UN Secretary General and the President of the Security Council. It also urged the international bodies to discharge their responsibilities to hold Israel accountable and to prevent the repetition of such attacks. Israel regularly targets positions inside of Syria, especially those of the resistance forces who have played a key role in fighting foreign-backed terrorism. A delegation from Lebanon's caretaker government has visited the Syrian capital, Damascus, the first such high-level trip in more than a decade. The ministerial delegation is headed by Lebanon's caretaker deputy prime minister. It was received by Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Mehdad, and the delegation discussed ways of boosting bilateral talks at a meeting with Syrian officials. The two sides also discussed the issue of securing electricity and natural gas from Jordan and Egypt through Syria.
The two sides discussed the difficult circumstances they are living, especially in the electricity and gas sectors. The Lebanese side asked Syria to help Lebanon in transferring Egyptian gas and Jordanian electricity through Syrian territories. The Syrian side welcomed our request and expressed Syria's readiness to assist. Both sides agreed to follow up the technical aspects and the details of implementation through a joint technical team.
Well, the plan involves using Egyptian gas to generate electricity in Jordan that will then be transmitted to Lebanon via Syria. Lebanon has been facing a crippling energy shortage that has hampered normal life there during the past 2 years. Last month, Lebanon's central bank announced a decision to end fuel subsidies, deepening the Arab nation's fuel crisis. Now, the Yemeni army says its forces have successfully liberated Rafah district in Yemen's Ma'rib province. Our correspondent Abdul Latif Al-Washali brings us more.
A new major victory has been achieved by the Yemeni army against the Saudi-backed forces in Yemen's oil-rich province of Ma'rib. Yemen's armed forces have recaptured the strategic Rahaba district and the southern Ma'rib, meaning that all supply routes linking Al-Bayda and Ma'rib will be cut off from the Saudi-backed forces.
Cutting off the supplies in Al-Rahba would weaken the enemy forces. There is also synchronization in the movement of our forces in the rest of the northern and southern fronts towards the city of Ma'rib, and this constitutes a siege on the city from all sides. All supplies have been cut off from the Saudi-led forces, and they can no longer carry out any military action. Light weapons will be more effective, and the army is now able to advance more towards Harib and Al-Juba.
The Yemeni army has also managed to take control of other military sites overlooking the city of Ma'rib from the western and northern sides, which would help the armed forces continue advancing towards the Harib and Al-Juba areas.
The Yemeni army managed to liberate the entire district of Al-Rahba and cut off the supply routes from Al-Bayda. With that, the liberation of Al-Juba and Habri area became easier for the Yemeni army. There is an insistence by the Yemeni army to liberate the city of Ma'rib, especially after the Saudi-led coalition's rejection of Ansarullah's recent initiative to stop military operations there.
For months now, the Yemeni army has been intensifying its military operations aimed at liberating the strategic Ma'rib province from the Saudi-backed forces, including terrorist groups. Ma'rib has strategic importance as an oil-rich province. It is the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen. Yemenis believe that their army will eventually liberate Ma'rib from all foreign powers, including the Saudi-backed forces. They say now Riyadh has to bear the consequences of its disregard for Ansarullah's recent initiative to end the ongoing crisis in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Clashes have been ongoing between the Taliban and forces loyal to local leader Ahmed Massoud in Afghanistan's Panjshir province, with both sides claiming to have inflicted casualties on each other. Anti-Taliban fighters in Panjshir say they have pushed back attacks and injured hundreds of Taliban forces. Massoud's supporters say the Taliban launched attacks from four different directions but have been unable to reach the valley. That is, while the Taliban deny casualties on their side, the group says it has advanced well into Panjshir and unofficially claims to have fully taken the valley after defeating resistance forces there. Celebratory gunfire was heard across the capital, Kabul, after Taliban sources say they have seized Panjshir. Now, the valley has been the only territory in Afghanistan that has put up resistance against the Taliban after the group's takeover of the country in mid-August. The group swept through Afghanistan days after the U.S. announced that it was withdrawing from the country after 2 decades. All American troops and forces of their allies have already evacuated the country. Now, Turkey has demanded the EU establish a new deal over the Afghan refugees. Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu says Ankara will not accept a certain amount of money from the EU while leaving the burden of the refugees to Turkey. Rashan Sakla brings us more from Istanbul.
Turkey has proposed to the European Union a substantial migrant deal. Turkish Foreign Minister said in a joint presser with Dutch Foreign Minister Sigrid Kaag that this time Turkey will not handle the burden of refugees alone and will need a new deal with the EU, unlike the previous one, where the bloc would only pay a certain amount of money and leave Turkey to handle the rest.
Türkiye olarak biz...
On the issue of the Afghan migrants, there will be no such cooperation if the EU's approach would be based on we give money and you keep them there. We have fulfilled our responsibility. The number of migrants trying to go to Europe has decreased 95%, but the EU did not do its part.
Following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan, Turkey tightened its security measures at the borders to prevent the wave of Afghan refugee influx to the country. Previously, the Turkish president said his country has no duty, obligation, or even responsibility to be Europe's refugee warehouse, assuring that international cooperation is needed to prevent a new migration wave from Afghanistan.
There is an urgent need for a new deal for sure. However, this time the deal will be different than the previous one due to the changes that took place worldwide. Not only is it up to EU and Turkey, but also the United States is involved in the issue of Afghan refugees. Turkey now has closed its borders in front of refugees, not only because a deal is not reached yet, but the burden of refugees is actually affecting the AKP internally as well. People started to feel the burden of migrants on the country and are now pressuring the government to stop receiving them.
The AKP is under pressure from opposition groups and citizens who are calling for a solution for the increasing number of refugees and foreigners residing in the country, which most likely will affect votes in the upcoming elections. Turkish citizens are complaining from unemployment, high demand on real estate, and other problems caused by the fact that Turkey has become a safe haven to those fleeing crisis-hit countries. The Turkish government now has to make a balance between fulfilling the needs of the EU and international community and surrendering to its own people's demand of sending the already existing refugees back. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Moving on to other news this hour. The government in Indian-controlled Kashmir has used communication blackout and clampdown to stop people from participating in the funeral prayers of pro-independence leader Syed Ali Shah Gilani. The iconic figure died on Wednesday at the age of 91 and was buried overnight. Our correspondent Shahana Butt reports.
An overnight security clampdown and communications blackout occurred in Indian-administered Kashmir after the region's iconic leader, Syed Ali Shah Gilani, died. The mosques in the region announced the demise. However, Gilani's followers were not able to participate in his funeral prayers.
Every home in Kashmir is mourning this loss. Authorities do not allow anyone to move out of homes. They should not have done this. It was our right to participate in his funeral prayers. After all, India claims to be a democracy. Can't we even mourn?
Officials say people's participation could have resulted in massive law and order problems.
Restrictions were imposed to keep law and order in place. No untoward incident occurred anywhere during the last 24 hours, and the situation has been peaceful.
Kashmir has witnessed a record number of internet blackouts in the world and is the world's largest militarized zone. Analysts say people of Kashmir have been forced into this silence since India stripped Kashmir of its autonomous status in August 2019.
The silence which was imposed upon the people is a human rights violation. They could not go to attend the funeral of their one of the veteran tallest leaders of Jammu and Kashmir, who has all along his life said and advocated about the right to self-determination.
The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has condemned the Indian government's denial of right to choose burial rituals inside of the Syed Ali Shah Gilani. Observers say people of Kashmir have been forced into a controlled kind of a life where every rule is not set by their choice, but by the force of the governing authorities.
Syed Ali Gilani was one of the tallest leaders of the resistance movement of Jammu and Kashmir and was advocating for right to self-determination. He deserved a respectful funeral, but the government did not allow the funeral to happen other than his family members. International covenants and international law says that every person who dies is to be handed over to his family for a choicest burial and a choicest funeral.
People of Kashmir say since the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party took a unanimous decision on Kashmir's special status in August 2019, a lot has changed without their consent. They say the silence of international community on the plight of Kashmiri people has added to their miseries, and with each passing day, living in the controlled land is getting difficult for them. And sooner or later, Kashmiri people are going to be the world's new asylum seekers. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
And now to news about COVID. Australia registers another record-breaking number of new coronavirus infections. Health officials logged over 1,700 new COVID cases. The state of New South Wales reported the bulk of these infections with over 1,500 new cases and four deaths. Recent daily infections are running about double the levels of Australia's previous worst wave a year ago. The states of Victoria, New South Wales, and the Australian Capital Territory have been under strict lockdown for weeks. Officials are urging people to get vaccinated, warning that the worst is yet to come. Authorities in New South Wales and Victoria say that vaccination is key in controlling the outbreak, and they are speeding it up. Iran has reported 515 new coronavirus fatalities, pushing the overall death tally to more than 110,000. More than 20,000 new infections were also registered during the past day. The total number of cases have exceeded 5.1 million. Other figures show a relative decline in the number of both deaths and infections. The government's mass vaccination rollouts, as well as people's willingness to follow health protocols, are the main reason for the relative decrease. Iran faced the fifth peak of COVID-19 in mid-August, with the number of infections standing at over 50,000. The Delta variant is blamed for the recent surge. Official data shows the U.S. economy added just 235,000 jobs in August, setting a disappointing month of hiring. The figure provided by the Labor Department is far below the forecast of economists, who expected for some 730,000 new jobs. The total for August is the worst since January. It is also a steep drop from July, when more than 1 million jobs were created. President Joe Biden blamed the surging Delta variant of COVID-19 for the weak job growth.
There's no question the Delta variant is why today's job report isn't stronger. I know people were looking, and I was hoping for a higher number. But next week, I'll lay out the next steps that we're going to need to combat the Delta variant.
Biden said he pulled the U.S. from, quote, economic freefall. However, he added that there is a lot more work to be done to fix the economy. The U.S. president is negotiating to get two massive spending bills through Congress, but even his fellow Democrats have shown a willingness to defy him over the $4.7 trillion packages. And with that, it brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Over the past decade, countries in the African continent have experienced an economic boom, but the benefits have not trickled down to the common people, and grinding poverty is still prevalent in many countries. So who benefits from Africa's poverty? A leading Pan-Africanist has the answer. Let's listen in.
The reality is the poverty of Africa is the glory of some civilizations. Poverty is an industry. Ignorance is an industry, big industry.
Hello and a warm welcome to yet another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an incisive analysis on events taking place in Africa. Now this week we are focusing on some of the roots of poverty in Africa, which has been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. In the second segment of our program, we shall head deep into Cameroon's rainforest that's facing danger from European Union companies that are on rampage, destroying this amazingly diverse ecosystem in their pursuit of profits.
The West and Africa's poverty. Over the last 20 years, Africa recorded strongest growth decade on record. In that period, the African narrative has swung from the hopeless continent to Africa rising. However, the experience of major African economies shows that the benefits of growth at the top are not trickling down to the poor. So where are the profits going? Well, some of the top 100 companies in all of Africa are mostly linked to former European colonial powers and the United States. The exploitation of Africa by neo-colonial powers continues unabated while the masses are sinking deeper into poverty.
Professor Howard Nicholas says Western countries want to ensure that Africa stays poor for the sake of survival of the developed world. Let's take a listen.
Africa historically, sub-Saharan Africa, has been fundamental to the global prosperity of the advanced countries. Okay? And Africa had a role to play. It has a role as a raw material producer. We will not allow sub-Saharan Africa to escape that. Okay, we do everything to keep sub-Saharan Africa where it is, also impoverished. It's absolutely vital for the prosperity of everyone else. So let's get clear about that. Okay, and this means all the economic structures, all the global institutions, and the economics we teach everyone is all designed to keep Africa exactly where it is.
Now, to discuss some of the reasons for the continued poverty in Africa, despite positive growth in most countries over the last several years, we have contacted Joseph Ochieno, a leading commentator on African affairs. Thank you very much, Mr. Ochieno, for your time. Now, rising poverty levels stand in sharp contrast to the large natural resource wealth and overwhelming young labor force of many African countries. What's really happening?
Because of all the complexities of the continent in the last 50 years, where somehow I don't think many of the leaders have got it right, it has meant that insufficient investment has gone into education, insufficient investment has gone into preparing the natural skill force of all the various countries on the African continent. I think nearly every country in the continent you can talk about. So for that reason, while we have a huge amount of resources, the labor force has been scanty, and the level of skills has been relatively low. And yet at the same time, partly because of the performance of the various African economies, some of the better performing African skills from the African continent have tended to find their ways mainly in the West.
While the era of colonialism in Africa is long gone, it's no secret that its effects are still being felt across the continent. In the wake of the recent economic growth in Africa, leading Western multinational corporations appear to be in a rush to grab the largest share of Africa's untapped resources. Pan-Africanist PLO Lumumba gives an example of the ongoing neo-colonial project to grab Africa's resources.
The neocolonial project requires that Africa must remain within the sphere of influence of these states. Today, if you look at the United Kingdom, which has left Europe, one would have thought that those are their cousins and that they should sit in comfort with them. You now see their involvement being de-emphasized in Europe and their interest and appetite growing towards the Commonwealth. Because in the Commonwealth, they are the major domos. They'll tell us what to do. In Europe, they have to grapple with the Germans and the French, and they don't like it. That is the unspoken bit of it. The French also are in Europe, but the Germans are too strong, and they don't like it. So they want to hold Côte d'Ivoire, Gabon, and tell them what to do.
Now, Mr. Ocheno, apart from the factor you earlier mentioned, we see that poverty remains in Africa while Western multinationals make abnormal profits. Are they continuing the colonial loot of African resources?
The challenges facing the African continent, as far as poverty is concerned, and indeed any other development issue, really is a matter that African governments and African leaders, and I suggest African peoples, particularly the young African population, should stand up, get counted, and commit themselves to change. I am delighted that in Zambia, the recent election that took place, a number of young people stood up. I know a number of people who were in the private sector who decided to get involved in the politics of the country, to simply say they want to be part of the change and they want to be able to influence the direction of the country. So in this continent, poverty is rarely a question of political debate and discourse. It's rarely a serious matter when it comes to academic discourse.
Well, according to our 2020 UNDP report, every year an estimated $88.6 billion, equivalent to 3.7% of Africa's GDP, leaves the continent as illicit capital flight. Now, Amina Mohammed, the Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, explains here on how these illicit financial flows affect Africa.
These staggering losses would be enough to fill 75% of the continent's health financing gap. They would more than be what is needed to achieve the Sustainable Development Goal on Inclusive Education, SDG 4, and they are one third of what Africa needs annually to fund infrastructure projects, foundation on which we would build our prosperity. These flows pose a threat to stability and security in African countries. They're undermining our institutions and democracy, and they jeopardize sustainable development and the rule of law.
Western multinationals are engaged in illicit financial flows and tax evasion in Africa, thus leaving many governments broke and unable to fund their budgets. What should be done to compel multinationals take responsibility and pay taxes to stop this massive loss by African countries?
I think the answer lies in very many facets. One, it lies with the African peoples, particularly the younger population of the African continent. The youth of Africa need to take a position, rise up, and begin to question their governments, number one. Number two, African governments, while they're being held to account, they need to begin to act slightly more on behalf of the citizens of Africa rather than on behalf of these multinationals. But number three, I think thanks to news media like yourselves, increasing campaigns means that it is possible now for some of the issues of exploitation of the African continent and resources to be addressed. I really look forward to a robust judiciary on the continent, where perhaps citizens take their governments to court, citizens take these multinationals to the domestic courts, and that the domestic courts have got the confidence, the judiciary have got the confidence to take these guys to task.
The IMF and the World Bank are viewed by many Africans as institutions which are instruments in the hands of great industrial powers of the world to subjugate African countries in favor of their domestic prosperity.
Femi Falana, a Nigerian human rights lawyer and activist, recently slammed African countries for implementing neoliberal policies.
We must take more than a passing interest in the socio-economic crisis in our country and the African continent. You have a situation where our governments are implementing neoliberal policies, dangerous policies, retrench workers, devalue your currency, withdraw subsidies from health, education, and the rest of them. And so how do you cope? You are multiplying and you are promoting poverty. And I'm talking of IMF and World Bank.
Now, Mr. Ocheno, how are World Bank and IMF austerity measures contributing to the poverty in Africa through loans which come with strict conditions that have affected major social sectors?
I can say that amongst many things in Uganda, and I can actually take you to Zambia, I can take you to many, many African countries, and that's really, really bad. Life has been the same. It's really been a shameful thing, the manner in which the IMF and the World Bank conduct themselves. But let me say so briefly. Once upon a time, I was in London, and I met a senior African diplomat who told me that he was part of a delegation with his president to the IMF and World Bank, and he met a Western minister who was instructing them to behave like a certain African president who was saying yes, yes to them, and unless they did that, they were not going to get IMF World Bank loans. What does it mean? It basically means that behave like these guys, you know, retrench, you know, cut down government, and give us access to exploitation.
African dictators, politicians, and corrupt bureaucrats stash their illicit wealth in Western countries. An investigative journalist from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists gives an insight here on how Africa's richest woman, Isabel dos Santos, looted her country's wealth assisted by American and European agents and financial institutions.
A whole swathe of service providers, the bankers, the lawyers, the oil companies, the consultants, have allowed the extraction of the resources that belong to the Angolan people from their country into Western capitals where this money gets reinvested.
Now, how have Western financial institutions contributed to the looting of Africa by dictators and multinationals?
Oh, it has been various by the many facets that I suggested. But I think the most common one for Western financial institutions is basically to be the conduits for loots. Western banks particularly routinely accept and store and help to stash off billions of dollars from Africa. You have cases of former Nigerian president who, you know, kept away perhaps, was it almost close to $5 billion, if I'm not wrong. So those cases where African leaders keep monies, usually looted money, on you know, in Western financial institutions, with the collusion of these banks and financial institutions.
Thanks, Mr. Ocheno, for your analysis, and it's always great having you. Now, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we shall focus on the ongoing destruction of Cameroon's pristine rainforests by European Union companies. Stay with us.
EU destroying Cameroon's rainforest for rubber.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Cameroonian activists recently gathered in front of the headquarters of the European Union delegation in the country's capital, Yaounde, to demand the end of the EU support for rubber originating from rainforest destruction.
The rally was held on the occasion of the International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples after 10,000 hectares of rainforest in the south of Cameroon, an area of about the size of Paris, were destroyed by the French multinational rubber company Halcyon Agri. indigenous people have been greatly affected by this destruction of the rainforest. An inhabitant of the forest speaks on deforestation.
La forêt est tellement importante pour nous. Alors quand quelqu'un vient donc toucher à ça, ça nous fait mal au cœur. Ça nous fait tellement mal au cœur. Parce que si nous voyons ce que les sociétés forestières ont fait dans les IFA, là où les engins passent, ils dévastent la forêt. Toutes les plantes et médecines qui sont là, ils déterrent ça, ils tuent ça. Et ça crée problème.
For more on the dangers facing Cameroon's rainforest, we have contacted Samuel Nguifo, an award-winning Cameroonian lawyer. He's the founder of the Center for Environmental Development. Thanks a lot for your time, Sam. Now, the European Union claims to be at the forefront of environmental conservation, yet companies from member states are destroying Cameroon's rainforest. This is clearly a case of double standards. Now, what's your take?
If I look at what is going on in not only in Cameroon, but in the rest of the Congo Basin countries in Central Africa, yes, there is a lot of logging activities going on. There is a lot of forest destruction going on involving companies of totally diverse nature, either logging companies or mining companies, companies involved in agro-industries, large construction companies. So this is a very clear trend that destruction is happening, and we see the forest clearly disappearing. We are very much concerned by what we see. And what we also hear is the speeches, the discourse in Europe and in the rest of the world. Everybody claims to be protecting the environment. But what some companies do is totally contrary to what their states are saying. And this is a trend also that we see, we have been witnessing in the past 30 years.
The government of Cameroon has been criticized for failing to take action to protect the country's rainforest. The masses feel they have been abandoned by the government and are now at the mercy of foreign companies destroying the rainforest.
Cameroon still has 40% of its indigenous forest. The government grants licenses for logging in alignment with their forestry policy. Despite this, illegal logging and land grabbing is a constant battle for the community. No major's Baka Pygmy community have a naturally strong commitment to protect their forest.
Why is the Cameroonian government failing to take tangible action to stop these European multinationals from destroying the country's rainforest?
I think that one of the most destructive actions against the forest, besides logging, was putting in the mind of the decision makers in Africa that they can't do it. They can't achieve development without logging. They have forest on their land. They were very lucky to receive this from nature, and they have to log. They have to grant logging rights. And a forest is supposed to be cut and provide income to the state. I think this is a major mistake. It's an assumption that is totally false. But our policies in Central Africa are all built on this assumption. Nobody thinks the forest can generate income without being logged.
It's estimated that nearly 40% of Cameroon is forested. However, the country is rapidly losing this critical natural resource. According to estimates, more than 3 million hectares of Cameroon's forests have been cleared since 1990, an area approximately the size of Belgium.
Now, Mr. Samuel, what is the general state of the rainforest in Cameroon?
We do not have like a yearly or a periodical assessment of what we have in the forest. So it's very difficult to have scientific grounds to really say what is going on. What we see from our visits on the field is that the forest is very clearly disappearing. A major part of the wildlife is also disappearing, And one of the reasons is that logging has opened access to the forest to many people, including poachers, who were able to go as far as possible to have access to wildlife habitat and log in a very huge quantity. So these are the side effects of logging.
Now, a very grim outlook there on Cameroon's rainforest, which needs collective action for its protection. The future of our planet is Africa, because the continent's people, biodiversity, and habitats are crucial for genetic diversity in face of climate change.
In a bid to meet the ever-growing demand of forest products and resources at international level, such as wood, palm oil, rubber, and other elements harnessed by industrial logging and extensive agriculture, this will only further deplete Africa's biggest carbon sink. What should be done to stop the destruction of the rainforest in Cameroon that is part of the Congo Basin rainforest area that absorbs carbon dioxide that would otherwise be released into the atmosphere?
I think the very first thing that we should do will be to have a meeting bringing together all the stakeholders to assess what has been done in forest management so far, and to learn the lessons that we can get from what we did in the past 20 years, 25 years, and from there to take decisions. Illegal logging is going on, legal logging is not sustainable, the forest is disappearing, and yet nobody says, let's stop and look behind us to see how we were able to perform. And then from there, let's plan the future. This would be done by any person with a little sense of logic to assess what he did. In fact, every single person at the end of the year assesses what happened in his life in the previous year. And on the grounds of the lessons learned, plans the future, right? Why don't we do it as a state, as a region, the Congo Basin? Why don't we do it for such an important resources that we were so blessed to have on our land?
In an effort to preserve the Cameroon rainforest, it's essential to have political will from the government to stop the greed by European multinationals which do not care about the environment. A local here feels corruption by the authorities is a major factor.
Now, are you optimistic that governments and international community will take action to save and preserve Cameroon's rainforest and indeed Africa's rainforest?
I think if we don't act very fast and if we don't act with very clear actions, efficient enough to change the trend that we are seeing, I think it will be too late very soon. I think the window that we have to act is probably closing very, very soon. So what we need to do today is an action on both, at both ends. We need to act in the consumer countries so that people understand that what they do by buying timber, by consuming timber products, if they are not careful enough, what they do is that they are contributing to the exacerbation of climate change. And we need to act at the producers' end by making sure that the states understand that the forest is on their land, but that they are part of humanity. And as such, they are obliged to think about not only their country or their communities, but also humanity.
Well, clearly, action has to be taken now to save Cameroon's rainforest, or it will be too late and the whole world will suffer the consequences. Well, that's all the time we had for this edition of Africa Today. Do drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know what you think about today's program. God bless you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Here at IRIB English Radio and The Key, we would like to offer our condolences to our listeners on the month of Muharram, the month in which the third Imam, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, was martyred. Today we're going to be examining a very important question, and that is, this. What are the distinctions of the revolution and uprising of Imam Hussein? We know that Imam Hussein's revolution, his uprising, was very special. If it wasn't special, we wouldn't be commemorating it up to now, so many years after it occurred. But what is it that makes it special? Of course, this is a subject that needs to be discussed in detail, and it is outside of the parameters of our program to mention all of the distinctions of this revolution. But we would like to mention here a few distinctions which can help illuminate why this revolution was so important and was so unique. The first distinction that we can mention is this, that the motive that pushed Imam Hussein to begin his revolution and his uprising was only the satisfaction of God Almighty and the revival of the religion of God and the revival of those noble virtues which had been destroyed by means of the evil people who came before him. The second distinction that we can mention is that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, in this uprising, in this revolution, and in the Battle of Ashura, was killed by a group of people who were apparently very pious Muslims. This is something which is very unique. Up to that point in time, most of the battles which had occurred in the history of Islam were battles that occurred with non-Muslims. But we see that Imam Hussein was martyred by a group of people who apparently, on face value, seemed to be very good Muslims. They were people who prayed, and they performed, apparently, outwardly performed many Islamic acts. This is also one of the distinctions of the revolution of Imam Hussein. A third distinction is that when we look at the companions of Imam Hussein who accompanied him in this battle and in his uprising, we see that they come from a wide spectrum of society. There's old people in it, there are young people in it, there are people who are Arabs, there are non-Arabs. There are many people who joined him in his uprising and fought with him in the Battle of Ashura. This is also something very unique, and something which makes his revolution distinct. There were people from his family, there were people from outside of his family, right? There were children, there were adults. This is another distinction of the revolution of Imam Hussein. Another distinction of Imam Hussein's revolution was his property and his characteristics of being oppressed. Right? This is something that we see reflected in the unfair battle that was fought on the two sides. On one hand, we see a small number of companions of Imam Hussein. On the other, we see a large army who had come to fight against him. This inequality is also one of the distinctions of this revolution and this battle. Finally, we see another distinction of this revolution is the effectiveness of this revolution and how much of an effect it had on human beings. We see that so many years after this revolution occurred, it still has an effect on people. And it still seems as if it happened just yesterday. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the distinctions of Imam Hussein's revolution. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.